Russell Carlton, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
One of the things I always say is I judge how much I enjoy a book by the amount of notes I make and pages I bend. So just very quickly, I don't know if you can tell, but there is a whole lot of that in this book. And I used to be very respectful. All books were holy to me, so I never think of writing in them. But I've gotten to a point where, rather than keeping notes on a notepad or something, I just write it in the margin. And if I do happen to give it to someone else after I'm finished with it, they can see what I've found fascinating, and maybe it'll do the same for them. It is a thought-provoking book, and basically, that is all I want from books these days. Like, you can read 100 biographies about Babe Ruth, and maybe every new one will have one or two more nuggets of information because the ability to do research is greater. But something like this, it takes a look at the whole game and how it's evolving or devolving, depending on your point of view. How did you come to this topic?
I wanted to write a book that, there's what happens on the field, and that's interesting and that's fun and that's wonderful to watch. But I think that there's something percolating under the surface about the game of baseball, and how it is very, very rapidly evolving. And I picked up on it's a very odd thing to say it's rapidly evolving because it doesn't feel like that in the moment. And I have a number of graphs in the book where I go, okay, let's take a look at the last 70 years. And some of those graphs, if you, when you look at them, various strategies, the way the players are used, things like that, they end with what I call a thwomp. And suddenly in the last 10 years, the kind of, it's just kind of the bottom drops out. And I felt that, and I've done some research and I've done some writing at Baseball Prospectus, and I knew that there was a lot of that out there. But I wanted to pull all that together because I think there are other people who have said, it's 10 years of real time, so it doesn't feel like a fast pace. But you also look back and you go, wow, the game is really played very differently than it was 10 years ago. And so I wanted to speak to that, and I wanted to write a book that kind of traced, okay, well, how did that happen? How did all that come about? When you start to look at it, and I'm a numbers guy, I'm not going to make any apologies for that. But when you start looking at it, it all has pretty reasonable explanations as to why. But I don't think anybody's really gathered those together and said, well, here's what's going on. Here's that funny feeling in your tummy that you think you have when you watch a baseball game. Here's where all of that comes from. And that was the whole point of, that I really wanted to make in the book.
And I have been remiss. I usually start off by saying the name of the book is The New Ball
Oh,
Game,
yes.
The New Ball Game, The Not So Hidden Forces Shaping Modern Baseball. Define
Yeah.
modern.
Well, modern is I guess up to this point. I mean, this is part of the problem of writing a current events book in baseball is that eventually the events don't become so current anymore. I was writing this, in fact, after I had turned in my first draft, they banned the shift, and that I had to go back and do a few rewrites in that chapter. This is kind of a flashpoint in time, and it is meant to be something that's kind of takes a look at where things are right now. I think one of the things, though, is that even over, in 5 years, some of the examples will be out of date. But I think some of the thought process around, what is baseball supposed to look like? That was a theme I kept coming back to in the book. It was a question that I think we've gone through a period where we just didn't ask that. And I think we've had MLB is kind of having to do some catch up around, well, do we want a game where, nearly a quarter of batters strike out? And well, if we don't, what can we do about that? Can we do anything about that? So I think that it is something that modern baseball is very much going to be, it is best illustrated and is illustrated in this book through very recent examples. But at the same time, I think that that tension is something that's going to dominate the conversation around the game for, probably the next 10, 20 years. What do we want this game of baseball to look like? And, can we, how well can we shape it? Is that a fight that we even have a chance at winning?
One of the things you just mentioned, you kind of wrap up the book, and I find it a great sense of humility on your part to understand that in a few years, all these things that you write about might change. One of the things I have noticed, this is the 20th anniversary of Moneyball, and I wonder at what point, and I just recently posted about all the books published since that came out that have some reference to it. A lot of business books about baseball refer to Moneyball, the Moneyball example. And I'm wondering at what point someone will come up with a new theory or something that will kind of push that, make that no longer as relevant. And that, baseball is an evolving process, and in a few years they might tinker with it, change things. You mentioned moving. One of the many suggestions they have about, and I put this in air quotes, improving the game
Sure.
is moving the mound back a little bit because
Yeah,
players are
sure.
stronger. And what that does scientifically in the process of throwing a baseball toward home plate. You talk about, and this is one thing I keep reading when I reread the rule book, and I don't know if people understand that, but the baseball is not uniform. There are minute differences in the size and weight of the ball that I imagine even within the same shipment of balls from whoever is producing them these days, there are going to be those differences. And the slightest difference can make a big difference in an at bat, the outcome of a game, even after a ball is put into play, whether a fielder can pick it up because of the spin of the ball, because of that minute difference in weight and size.
I mean, one of the things, and I said this, of all the threads that run through the game, I don't know that people would have thought about the thread literally running through the ball. And one of the things that we've seen from research that has been done by a number of other people, Dr. Meredith Wells is one of the folks who's done some wonderful work on this, is that we see that seemingly in about 2015, we all noticed that, wait a minute, why is the ball flying out of the park all of a sudden and just massive numbers of home runs were being hit. It's very odd because we look at the ball and like the physical ball, you deconstruct it and you look at the different pieces of it, and it looks as though somebody made a change, whether that was intentional. And MLB has said, no, there was no intent here. We weren't juicing the ball. We weren't doctoring it. There was nothing conscious here. But at the same time, it happened, and it may have just been somebody sourced something from somewhere else. And that made the ball dry a little tighter or be a little lighter or something like that. And when we look at that, well, it produced some really, really big pieces of the game. I mean, we went through a 5-year period where home run rates were just off the charts. And it's interesting because for all of the work that we try to put into moving the game toward more aesthetically pleasing or whatever way you want to try and move the game, along comes this one minor change that maybe no one even really consciously made, and it really affects the product on the field. And I think that, I think MLB of course became aware of it, and they've taken specific pains to try and correct it. But I think that particular piece also drove a lot of strategy in the game. You had a ball that was more willing to fly out of the park. Well, more guys are going to take an uppercut swing to try and help the ball along its way. I mean, if the ball's going to do the work, I'm going to take the chance. It changes the way that the cost benefit analysis of trying to play, what I call swing real hard in case you hit it. There was just a lot of change that went with that, and in a way that you wouldn't think of just from that one little piece of, oh, the yarn's a little different, or the thread's a little different, and those minor events can have some really long lasting and really big effects on the game. But you really have to stop and take it all the way down the line and look into it before you realize that, oh, that's what happened. It's one of the things that one of those threads that I did try to run through the book is that, sometimes you have to wait for 10 years to really see the outcome of something, and to really understand its effects. But even minor differences can end up having very strong effects on the game. And so again, just trying to trace some of those things through the past 7 years, but up until today, to say, why does the game feel different now?
One of the things that comes to my mind is the difference between the game as played on the field and the game as perceived by fans. One of the things, you have a chapter in here, Did Analytics Ruin Baseball? Certainly over the last several years, there has been a plethora of new statistics, new analytics. I was watching the Met game last night, and Pete Alonso hit a ball that the announcers are just, there's a fly ball to left field, and it kept going and going and going. And they made a reference to something that you never would have heard of a few years ago, the launch angle of the ball. They said the launch angle is 42%. And when you think about it, the higher the launch angle, it stands to reason that the higher up it would go, the straighter up it would go, and would not go out of the ballpark, because it's like the joke in Major League when somebody hit a ball and then one of the fans says it was too high to be a home run. But these new analytics, I'm waiting for them to start showing up on the backs of baseball cards, to supplant the batting average. And you
Sure.
make reference to how our runs batted in are not a real indicator of a player's ability,
Right.
because so much is out of that player's control. He does not control who gets on base ahead of him. Just that's what I mean. There's so many things to think about. I can't contain them all. Now,
I mean,
your background
there's a lot of
is
it. Yeah.
your background is basically not a sports background. Like a lot of books are written by sports reporters or broadcasters or people involved in the game. For a while, there were a lot of books coming out by ex-players talking about what's wrong with the game. And talk a little about your background and how that applies to what you've done here.
Well, I'm, my academic background, I actually hold a PhD in clinical psychology. So, in a very real way, I'm very much an outsider in the game. I mean, I have worked in a couple of front offices. I've done a little bit of that work, but I don't come from that. I certainly don't come from a playing background. My career ended in seventh grade due to a tragic lack of talent. And probably should have ended before then, but that's neither here nor there. With that though, I mean, I at once I have an academic background, and so I have lived in a world of show me the number, show me the evidence. And so when Moneyball came out and I was in graduate school and I read it, I was like, oh, this is all stuff that I This is all really good stuff. And wait a minute, I have the skills to do this stuff. And I remember I needed a free hobby because I was a poor grad student at the time. And I, started picking around on some numbers and saying, well, what happened here? But as I've gone further on, the clinical psychology background has really served me well, because there's always the question of why would a person do this? And what is the thought process that goes through someone's head as they're doing whatever it is they're doing? And in this case, as a baseball player, okay, if I were in this situation, I'm a manager who needs to get nine outs to finish off this game. Do I want to stick with my tired starter? Or do I want to go to the bullpen? How tired is my starter? How good is my bullpen? And to be able to put yourself into those situations and think about, okay, what would a manager be thinking about in these situations? And I think that, a lot of the new analytics are trying to model better in terms of, well, what are the relevant factors that should go into that decision? Maybe not the ones that everybody uses, but what are the ones? And then also in that way to say, well, if there's a break between what seems to be going through people's minds as they make decisions and what they actually should be paying attention to. Well, what is the problem there? What's the distinction there? And I talk about two parts of the game. One is, what is the analytic way to look at this, but also the ability of the game to tell a story. And as a clinical psychologist, you have to respect someone's story. You want to listen to their story. You know, a lot of the things that we talk about in baseball that are, analytically not correct anymore, the sacrifice bunt is one of them. Sacrifice bunt is a terrible play from a numbers perspective. You give up an out, and that out is really super valuable, and it's more valuable than than pushing that guy to second base. And I can show you the numbers, and I can do the chart, and here it is, and it's all there in black and white. But the sacrifice bunt is a really interesting play if you look at it from the point of view of a narrative of baseball telling a story. You know, a guy gives up his at bat in service of his team. That's kind of cool. We like people who do that. And not only that, you know, we're there even more so than to win the game. We watch games because they are public art. We watch them because we like them to tell a story. And I think that, you know, in the last 20, 25 years since Moneyball came out, the game has gone so hard toward efficiency at all costs, and efficiency being the standard that we measure everything, that it forgot that, well, maybe some of those things were kind of nice to watch, even if they weren't statistically correct. And I mean, you can't make people do something that's going to go against their best interest in winning the game. So some of this stuff may be gone for forever. But at the same time, I think that there's a real way in which, you know, people, when they think about the game and they talk about the game, that they miss some of that ability of the game to tell a story. And so I think that some of the backlash against analytics, and you mentioned the title of chapter 8 of Did Analytics Ruin Baseball? And I put that there very provocatively and very purposefully. Hopefully somebody in Barnes and Noble is standing there now going, I want to read this book because I want to know the answer to that question. You know, there is a way in which it did. And I think that, you know, as an analyst myself, and as a, been writing about this stuff for goodness 15 years or so, you know, there has to be a way where I say, you know, look, there have been ways in which the game has been made worse by analytics. Better too, but we have to acknowledge both sides of that. And I think that, you know, that background as a clinical psychologist is what brought me to the ability to have that conversation internally and then to put that down in the book.
One of the things that fans, thoughtful fans, look back on is, you know, what if is a big topic of interest. And you talk about what would happen if you would take, if you would switch a generation player, take today's players, put them back in Babe Ruth's era, and vice versa, take players from Babe Ruth's era and put them in today, which would be able to maintain their talent better, given all the differences between then and now. And I thought that was fascinating. You talk about telling a story, and you give several box scores. And box scores are becoming increasingly rare in newspapers today, as more and more newspapers gut their sports department. But looking at these box scores, you find a way to tell a story by looking at what would to most appear just to be a jumble of numbers next to a name, next to a position, but you're able to parse it out very effectively in telling the story. And I think a lot of the game, especially for older people who've been involved in the game for many years, remember when they went to their first game, and the ability to sit with their whoever brought them there and have them say, you know, I once saw, you know, Mickey Mantle hit a home run over that fence over there. And it connects the generation. It sounds very fairy tale-ish. I don't know what the right word is,
But
but
it's true, though. It is. You know, I mean, I went to games with my dad, and I mean, that's real. And I think that through line is something that feels, it kind of feels like people feel like that's being disrespected in some way. And if you want to talk about the modern game, in that, you know, there isn't that point of connection anymore, and that it feels like a different game of baseball. And, you know, is this, Is this the same game that when I went to my first game in 1986 that I watched with my dad? And the answer is, well, no. Well, what does that mean? And so I think that you're right that there is a certain point where I bring up the box scores as a storytelling device, and I think that there has been a way in which analytics has been underused in the game. Yes, it's definitely used in front offices. Yes, it's done as a way to get as much efficiency out of the game as you can. But I think it also has very strong storytelling powers if we know what to do with it. And I think that it's either stereotyped as, the search for cheap, junk stats or weird trivia or fun factoids that they say, somebody went 7 for 23 when the sun was shining and they were playing in Missouri and it was the third inning and whatever. And that's, I mean, that's just silly. That doesn't really, but I tried to use at least analytics as a way to tell the story of how the game has changed. And you mentioned the box scores, and I put a box score in each chapter that meant something. And sometimes it was just one little factoid that I pulled out of it. And sometimes it was, let's take a deep dive into this one and say and see some piece of the modern game and how this box score reveals it. And it was something that I kind of hit on when I started writing the book, and I said, I'm gonna follow this thread. And it worked out really well for me. I was really happy with that piece of it.
Well, one of the things I would find interesting, and maybe this is a book you will write in the future, baseball is the only major professional sport where the size and layout of the field is not uniform. And certainly that plays into a place like the Oakland's home field that has a very large foul space. Foul territory versus and farther down the outfield there are places that are very, very narrow. So you don't have the fielders don't have the opportunity to make plays that they would have in different stadiums. Whereas a football field is 100 yards by whatever, 50 yards wide. I don't follow football, so I don't know. But certainly it's a level playing field in other sports, being that it's the same size. And I would be interested in seeing some conjecture on how that plays. Certainly, I would imagine a player might not want to go to play in Colorado, knowing that a pitcher might not want to deal with the elevation and having the ball fly out of the ballpark. And then how does that play into how a team puts together its roster and its system and even signing the younger players, the players out of high school and college, especially in high school where you can't imagine, even with all the analytics it can use, how will this player develop over from between 18 and 22 or 23, and younger players for those who sign out of foreign countries. So, what do you see as your next project? Do you have another book
Oh
project
goodness.
in mind, or you just want to relax for a little while?
I just got done with this one. I mean it, I never thought I'd write a second book. I wrote the first one, The Shift, The Next Evolution in Baseball Thinking, in 2018. And at first I thought that was gonna be my only book.
All right, so
And
let me interrupt you there.
yeah.
That book came out in 2018. This book came out 5 years later. How much of what you wrote in that book is still valid?
There's a good chunk of that that's still valid. There are places that when I go back and I read it, I'm like, oh, I totally would have done this different. Most of when I reread The Shift from 5 years ago, that I kind of cringe at is like, well, it's not that this is wrong, but I know more now than I did at the time when I was writing that. But I
More
think
as
that,
a
again, a
baseball
lot of it.
analyst or more as a writer? Because
Yes.
I also want to talk about writing the
Both.
book.
Right, yeah. I mean, as an analyst, I mean that some of the stuff I look back on and I go, well, I mean, since then I've done some additional research and I would have put that in there. This one, in terms of the writing process, and this is, as somebody who is, I'm not a trained journalist either, so I'm, I'm not a trained baseball person. I'm not a trained journalist. So what am I doing writing a baseball book? But at the same time, I mean, as someone who's kind of self-taught, when I pitched this one, when I pitched the new ball game to the publisher, they said, "Well, what makes this one different than the fifth?" And I said, "Well, this one has an arc," and I said, "I want to run through around the theme of, why is baseball different?" The first one was much more just kind of, I had some things I wanted to say, and then they all kind of jumbled nicely together into a book, and I put some chapter blocks on it, and this one I was much more purposeful in terms of having a broader theme and pulling in some other elements. We talked about the box score piece that I tried to weave in there, and there's something I talked about in the first chapter and throughout called the five fact speech that where when you introduce yourself to someone, you're supposed to say who you are, but where you're from, where you live now, what you do, what your family status is, and then an interesting hobby. And so, I'm Russell. I'm from Cleveland. I live in Atlanta. I'm a clinical psychologist, researcher, married with five kids, and I love baseball. And and it's one of those things that people don't think about that they do until they're like, we realize that somebody pointed out, oh, you do that, and so, as a writer, I wanted to pull, I think I've, hopefully gotten better at the craft itself. But I wrote the book with the thought in mind of, hey, I want to do something a little bit more than just random observations about baseball. And I think that that's, if I see maturity in myself as a as an author the second time around, I think that would be it, is that ability to say, hey, this book has an arc, and to actually put that arc together and to run it all the way through the book. So I mean, it's, if other people are out there thinking of writing a baseball book, because goodness knows that won't be me for a while, but then I said that the last time. That's kind of where I would point them to, is that, as you go through and plot out the ideas, or even if as you just read books, look for what is that connecting arc. And the cool thing about baseball is that, there are hundreds of arcs that run through the game. It's, one of the nicest things about the game is that there are so many different ways to appreciate it and to be a fan of it. And for me, I found my one little pathway that that I find, and hopefully others will walk that path with me. But if I write another book, it will probably, I will try to find some other way to make that, to find another path that kind of works for me. But as of right now, I think I'm just gonna rest for now before I launch into another project. Because
Now, this book was
writing a book is about a 2-year commitment from start to finish, so.
published by Triumph. I don't have the other one to shift at my fingertips. Was that also from Triumph?
Yes, it was also Triumph, yeah.
Did you shop around for a publisher first, or you went straight to Triumph? How did that process
I just
go?
went straight to Triumph. I mean, one of the nice things, because I'm not a professional author, this is a hobby for me. I don't make my money off of this. I did not have, I don't have to sit there and think, well, this is how I'm going to feed my family. And so I had a good working relationship with Triumph, and I called them and I said, hey, I've got this idea. And I'd stayed in touch with them after the shift. And so when I came back and said, I have an idea, they said, yeah, let's set up a call. And they were, they have always treated me very fairly and very kindly. And I have worked on that relationship has been very good to me. And I will say that that has probably meant more to me than, an extra 1,000 or 20,000 or whatever it is I could have made. Is that, this is a book is such a long commitment, and there's so many steps that go on behind the scenes that nobody ever sees until you really try to do one. It's good to have a group of people that you trust and that you work with well, and that can, walk you through that process, because it is such a long track to do.
Well, the proof is in the pudding. This is an excellent book, highly recommended to any serious fan about the overall scope of the game. We've been talking with Russell Carlton, author of The New Ball Game, The Not So Hidden Forces Shaping Modern Baseball. Russell, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
Sorry, I had to look for the stop button.
Oh, that's fine.
I normally wear glasses, but I had cataract surgery a while ago, and I find that
Oh,
they are
goodness.
actually an impediment to seeing quite often. So, Triumph does Triumph books are hit or miss. There are a lot of formulaic books that I don't really get involved with, like, the 100 things Indians fans
Yeah.
must know before they die, but often they come out with really good ones like this. And like I say, I don't think I could give this one away because there's so many markings in it. But again, it's an indication of how much I enjoy the book. So thank you for that. It's really a fun read.
Kindly.
I'll be working on this shortly. And I should have asked, do you have a website or some online presence that I can include with the intro?
Yeah, just the Twitter is really it. Because I don't, there's no website for the book other than maybe Triumph has a page on their main site, but
You're still writing for Baseball Prospectus?
oh yeah, BP, yeah, BP stuff. That's right.
Yeah.
In fact, I have to file tonight, actually. So,
What's your well, is it still Twitter? I don't really. I'm not.
yeah, it's whatever they're calling Twitter now, but yeah, Pizza Cutter 4.
What's your handle there?
That's Pizza Cutter 4, PizzaCutter 4.
And your kids? How old are your kids?
Oh goodness. What day is it? We just had birthdays, so yeah, it's what four, okay, so 14, 12, 9, 6, 6.
All
So
right. Are they baseball fans too? Have they followed in your footsteps?
no.
No.
As much as I have tried, I took them out to I've taken them out to Truist Park a number of times, and tried to kind of get them into it. My 6-year-olds maybe are showing signs of possibly getting into baseball, but